This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Words are wonderful things. Used skillfully, they can, in the absence of vision, bring to mind images, ideas, and memories. And that's the challenge for the Antiques Radio Show. In previous programmes, we've had themes such as fakes and mini-themes linking items together by virtue of belonging to a famous person or by type of object, etc. But what if there's no linkage? Do I call it a job lot, a hotchpotch, or a mixture? Well, that's rather dull and dreary. What about eclectic collection, rich panorama, or potpourri? A bit precious and over the top, I think. One word I do like is the soft-sounding French term mélange. So what's in our mélange of items in the programme today? We offer an historical method of getting rid of blood-sucking household pests. Then there's a Maori weapon which would do the same job in a very different way. We hear about a helmet which has a beauty of its own, linking military science and art. Add in some ceramics and some miniature historical characters, and then a Jewish ritual item from Iraq. The second half of the programme details an upcoming splendid art display, very much inclusive of the sight impaired. We look at what happens to silver items that don't follow the rule book in Britain, the fate of fakes. And a new musical. What object is it based on? So let's get started with our household pest. Do you have a problem with vampires? No? Well, that's good. But this story is for those who do. And what if you can't find a handy priest to conduct an exorcism and there's nothing helpful on the shelves in the supermarket? Well, how about a DIY kit? Where would you get one and what would be in it? We reveal all. And this comes from news.artnet.com on the 23rd of July and was written by Tanner West. A vampire-slaying kit, complete with 19th-century Bible and a small pistol, just sold for $3,100 at an English auction house. And that's US dollars. It's possible the buyer himself is a vampire seeking to protect himself. We have no evidence, but it's possible. Auction houses often sell off strange items, but sometimes the offerings are downright batty. This week, an ornate kit for slaying vampires hit the block at an online sale mounted by Hanson's Auctioneers in Derbyshire, England. The Edwardian-era kit comes in a velvet silk-lined box with an interior lid adorned by a painting of Christ's resurrection. Inside is everything you need to kill a caped creature of the undead. Three crucifixes, some rosary beads, a Bible, a small pistol, a pocket knife with a silver blade, tooth-pulling pliers, and, inexplicably, a vial of shark's teeth. The task of killing a vampire was extremely serious, and historical accounts suggested the need for particular methods and tools, the auction house's founder, Charles Hanson, said in a statement. Items of religious significance, such as crucifixes and Bibles, were said to repel these monsters, hence their strong presence in the kit we have found. At the completion of the four-day sale, the item hammered down at £2,500, squarely within its pre-sale estimate of £2,000 to £3,000. The name of the eventual buyer was not disclosed. One theory floated just now by this writer is that he is a vampire himself, an auction-savvy bloodsucker with some extra liquidity seeking to destroy anything that threatens his external existence. The kit, while old, is not believed to be the kind of authentic vampire-killing set that would have been available in the 1800s. The auction house dated the box back to around 1780, while the Bible was published in 1842, and the knife hails from the early 20th century. The kit is a mixture of five or six different traditions that you never would have seen in a real one, and there were some real ones, Robert A. Smart, an English professor at Quinnipiac University, told the New York Times. Authentic kits would have included such things like herbs, holy water, and silver bullets, he added, and the pocket knife was too small to do the job. The consigner is an anonymous collector who purchased it at an antique fair, thinking it would make good dinner party fodder. It's believed to have been put together in the early 1900s, when vampire lore was brought back into the culture of conversation by Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, published in 1897. Boxes like this have been made privately and commercially ever since, Hansen's auctioneer Rick Alexander said in a statement. Though our kit had an early Bible and the boxes earlier, it appears to have been assembled around the Edwardian period in England. By this point, the Dracula novel was having a big impact. And thank you, ArtNet News and Tanner West, for that information. Well, maybe there's an easier way to get rid of a vampire, simply to hit it hard on the head. Well, here's a story about a handy weapon from New Zealand, a mere, spelt M-E-R-E, a teardrop-shaped weapon ideal for dispatching tiresome vampires. Let's find out a little bit more. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 1st of August. Maori greenstone brought to Britain by 1820s adventurer. Pictured here is one of two 19th century or earlier Maori greenstones mere offered for sale by Reeman Danzi in Colchester on June the 30th, writes Roland Arkell. Made in the highly valued Punamu stone for traditional, quote, close-quarter combat, mere were the most revered of all Maori weapons. They are highly collectible today, with these selling well over estimate at bids of £9,600 and £12,500 to buyers using thesaleroom.com. Both came for sale from the Weller Poley family of Boxted Hall in Suffolk, descendants of George Weller Poley, 1783 to 1849, an adventurer who visited New Zealand in the 1820s. He brought back a number of Maori artefacts, including the preserved head of a warrior, or Moko Mokai, that caused an international incident when offered for sale at Bonhams in 1988. At the 11th hour, the consigner, Nancy Wellapoli, agreed to withdraw the head and deliver it to the New Zealand authorities, receiving in exchange a contemporary Maori greenstone mere as a token of thanks. It too was offered at the Colchester sale, but it was passed in at estimates of £2,000 to £3,000. And that was from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 1st of August and Roland Arkell. On a purely cost-benefit basis, it would be cheaper to use the DIY vampire slaying kit at £2,500 from Hansen's Auctions of Derbyshire than the mere at £12,500 from Reeman Danzi of Colchester. If anyone can give me a comparative quote for an exorcism, I'd be interested to hear and put it out to the tender process. And now, staying with warfare, is it art or science? Do art and science coalesce? A visit to Sydney's Powerhouse Museum, now rebranded back to its earlier title of Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences, exhibits a graphic portrayal of both sides of the equation and the fusion of the two. And here's a piece that would not be out of place if it were in the Powerhouse Museum. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 4th of July and is written by Alex Capon. Masterpieces of the Armourer's Arts Tops Classic Week in New York. The top lot of the latest Christie's Classic Week was the Corinthian helmet from circa 525 to 475 BC, which sold for $700,000 US, against an estimate of $300,000 to $500,000. The archaic period bronze form represented the most successful helmet type of its day due to both its functional qualities, leaving only a small area of the warrior's face exposed, but also for its aesthetic elegance. The type was described by Dr. Mark Maroney of the Mugen's Museum of Classical Art as a masterpiece of the armourer's art, with a highly domed skull, gracefully curving cheek pieces, and a slender nasal guard. The 54-lot antiquities auction, as a whole, raised $1.95 million. However, the total generated by Classic Week in New York was well down on previous years. The overall total, including premium, was $13.4 million, a figure which compared with $79.5 million raised by the equivalent sale last year, and $60 million for Christie's Classic Week in October. This was due to the postponement of a number of major sales during the period following the coronavirus. Thank you, Antique Trade Gazette and Alex Capon. Let's move to more peaceful pursuits. We often hear about European porcelain and, of course, Chinese ceramics. Let's put the spotlight on some non-Chinese china. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 4th of July. A new benchmark for Vietnamese ceramics. Christie's claimed a new record for Vietnamese ceramics when a large 15th century blue and white storage jar sold for a surprise €380,000 as part of the Art d'Asie sale in Paris on June the 23rd. It came for sale from a Dutch collection with an estimate of €15,000 to €20,000. Two key events spurred the development of the Vietnamese ceramic industries in the 15th century: the Chinese annexation of Vietnam from 1407 to 1428, and the imperial ban on ceramic exports from 1436 to 65. Ironically, it was during the occupation by the Ming that the blue and white technology was first introduced to Vietnam. In turn, the 30-year prohibition on China trade that followed provided the stimulus for the Vietnamese potters to hone their skills at a time of high demand but little direct competition. Yuan and Ming prototypes provide the forms and decoration for Vietnamese blue and white. However, these were not simply slavish copies. In addition to a noticeably heavier body, these are stonewares rather than porcelain, both brushwork and decorative motifs help differentiate early Vietnamese porcelain from its Chinese counterparts. This 13-inch, 33-centimetre, high jar shares the same peony scrolls and Buddhist lion decoration as another once owned by John D. Rockefeller and now in the collection of the Asia Society. Similar shrouds have been excavated at the Noi and Chu Dao kiln sites. It was consigned by the family of J.E. Hagen, 1904 to 76, a Dutch colonial civil servant who had received it as a gift in 1947 when working in Indonesia. The price takes Vietnamese ceramics into new territory. In December 2017, a massive 2-foot-10-inch, that's 84 centimetre, blue and white storage jar with moulded animal masks, handles dated to the 15th or 16th century, sold for $100,000 at Bonhams in San Francisco. In the last Antiques Radio show, that's number 21, we mentioned the book by Timothy Schroeder entitled A Marvel to Behold, all about the treasures of Henry VIII and, of course, what he did and did not hand on to his descendants. Who were the dramatis personae? Well, here they are, and you could have bought them at a price. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 1st of August. Meet the Tudors in miniature form. A bidding battle broke out at Kinski's in Vienna on June the 23rd for a pair of figures fashioned as King Henry VIII and his daughter Elizabeth I, each about 13 inches, that's 32 centimetres, high. They were catalogued as 17th or 18th century in date and wearing contemporary dress and came from the following provenance: purchased from the property of the English Princess Margaret 50 years ago in Stuttgart, Austrian private collection. Bidding started at €5,000, but in the next few minutes the price soared to no less than €210,000, with the hammer falling to an English bidder. It is possible that the figures are of English origin and were perhaps made as historical models intended for adults rather than as toys, royal portrait figures such as these being popular subjects from the early 18th century. And the article continues with details of some other items in the sale. And now for something completely different, a different era, a different country, and a different faith. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 30th of May. Big tick for scroll container. this 3 foot, 91 centimeter high, hard-sided tick or torus scroll container is shown open and closed and is representative of the type used in the Sephardic tradition. During services, the tick was placed upright on the reader's desk and the Torah is chanted without removing the scroll from the case. Fashioned from wood cased in sheets of embossed silver and embellished with glass beads, similar vessels were also made in brass, the construction made it easy to transport and provide protection for the contents. It was almost certainly made in Baghdad in the late 19th or early 20th century and was once a relatively common object in Iraq synagogues or those of the Baghdadi Jewish tradition. The tick includes a Hebrew dedicatory inscription. Many of these were lost during the Second World War, so although missing two of the finials that hung from the onion dome and lacking the manuscript, it is a scarce object today. Estimated to bring £1,500 to £2,500 at King Russell auctions in London on April the 28th, it sold for £6,500 to a buyer on thesaleroom.com. And that is approximately $15,000 Australian all up with buyer's premium. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. Earlier in this programme, we touched upon how words, if skillfully used, can bring to the mind images and objects which we can't see. And here's a little more on that theme and another way of looking at things. And I'm reading from a press release sent to me in a private communication on the 27th of July. Sculpture by the Sea, Bondi, the world's largest annual free-to-the-public outdoor sculpture exhibition, returns for its 24th year to the spectacular Bondi to Tamarama Coastal Walk from the 22nd of October to the 8th of November 2020. The iconic exhibition will see the coastline transformed into a 2-kilometre-long sculpture park over 3 weeks, featuring over 100 sculptures by an exciting and diverse collection of artists from 15 countries, including Japan, New Zealand, Norway, France, Czech Republic, Ukraine, Greece, China, and Australia, as well as every state and territory in Australia. Sculpture by the Sea also runs an access and inclusion programme to ensure the free-to-the-public exhibitions are inclusive and positively encourage the participation of people with diverse abilities of all ages to enjoy and experience sculpture in a beautiful setting. Visitors with disability and their carers are invited to participate in a free tactile tour of some of the sculpture in the exhibition with experienced guides. Tactile tours are designed to introduce visitors with disability to new ways of experiencing and enjoying contemporary sculpture through informed discussion and touch. Audio descriptions and verbal descriptions of the sculptures visited during the tours are offered to participants who are blind or vision impaired. As one of Sydney's most beloved and photographed events, Sculpture by the Sea attracts approximately 450,000 visitors over the course of 18 days and signals the beginning of summer in Sydney. And thank you, Harriet Dixon-Smith, for that communication and information. She is Director of Communications and Business Affairs at Nixco, which is covering the up-and-coming Sculpture by the Sea. Previously on the Antiques Radio Show, in Programme 19, I raised the issue of the 1790s hallmarked christening mug having a spout added in the 1990s to make it more useful. It's clearly not a genuine 1790s jug. It only became a jug in the 1990s. So is it a fake? We don't need to argue the point or debate if there was or was not deceit. Under British law, the 1973 Hallmarking Act, it is illegal. Why? Firstly, the function of the item has been changed from mug to jug. Secondly, there's an illegal addition, the spout. Additional silver is permitted for patches or repairs up to a weight of 5 grams, which is a very small amount. The spout would greatly exceed this weight. What should have happened and what might happen now? Ideally, at the time the spout was added to the mug, in let's say 1990, it should have been submitted for assay at one of the four assay offices, London, Birmingham, Sheffield and Edinburgh. The spout would have been tested, and if up to standard, most commonly it would have been hallmarked for 1990 on the spout. The jug therefore has two sets of marks, one for the body for 1790 and one for the spout 1990. The item has been made legal or regularised. But if the spout wasn't hallmarked in 1990, what happens in 2020? If it turned up for sale and was noticed in England, it would be placed before the Antique Plate Committee, which adjudicates on such matters. It would be quickly determined as being illegal, the later unmarked spout. The 1790 marks would be cancelled, i.e. crossed out, but still visible. There would be the option for the owner to resubmit the item for assay, and if it was up to standard, to be remarked. This again regularises the item. All of this and lots more information is contained in the brochure Antique Silver and the Law, that's British law of course, which was offered to listeners in Programme 19. If you want to listen to it again, or any other previous Antiques radio show programme, they're podcast on the 2RPH website. Just go to 2rph.org.au and click on the programme button, then podcasts, and Bob's your uncle. Do you know the origins of that expression? Well, here's the answer, and it comes from one of my favourite books, Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. And this is the 14th edition on page 134. And Bob's your uncle. That will be all right. You needn't bother anymore. Just leave it to me. The phrase was occasioned by A.J. Balfour's promotion by his uncle, Robert, Lord Salisbury, the Tory Prime Minister, to the post of Chief Secretary for Ireland. Balfour had previously been made President of the Local Government Board in 1886, then Secretary for Scotland, with a seat in the Cabinet. The suggestion of nepotism was difficult to ignore. And in Australia, we usually say, "She's apples, mate," but it has the same sort of meaning. So next time you're in a quiz show and are asked, "Who is Bob?" in the expression, "Bob's your uncle," you know the answer is British Prime Minister Robert Balfour. I hope that wins you the cash prize, but probably not enough money to buy you the subject of our next piece. Do you recall the Leonardo da Vinci painting called Salvatore Mundi, a painting of the Saviour of the world, Jesus Christ, one hand raised, the other holding a glass globe, sold for around 650 million Australian dollars? Well, now it has a musical score. And this is from The Art Newspaper and Gareth Harris, 29th of July. Salvatore Mundi, the musical tale of world's most expensive painting to be turned into a stage blockbuster. Kiola Productions plan to put on the show, a mix of Hamilton and Willy Wonka, in New York in 2022. The saga of Salvatore Mundi, the work purportedly by Leonardo that sold for a record $450 million at auction in 2017, is to be turned into a stage musical. The Kiola Productions company, whose other musicals include Dear Evan Hansen and Tina, the Tina Turner musical, plans to stage the show in New York sometime in 2022. Salvatore Mundi, the musical, will mix the historical reportage of Hamilton with the fantasy and delight of Willy Wonka's Golden Ticket, the company says. It will follow the story of how a shredded, scratched, wooden panel painting of Jesus, purchased for $1,100 in 2005, evolved to become the Leonardo da Vinci masterpiece, lost for over 500 years, titled Salvatore Mundi, that in 2017 was auctioned at Christie's Auction House for over $450 million, says a Kiola production statement. At the 2005 auction, possibly in Louisiana or Virginia, the work is thought to have sold for less than $10,000. The writer and dramatist Deborah Grace Weiner will write a book to accompany the new show, and Kiola Productions is still talking with composers and lyricists, says a spokesman. Since a Salvatore Mundi appearance after a first lengthy restoration at the Leonardo exhibition at the National Gallery London in 2011-2012, and its sale in 2017 at Christie's New York, the painting has attracted controversy, doubt, and scholarly acrimony. The history of the panel and its origins in the Royal Collections of England have been challenged, and several Leonardo experts have cast doubt on the attribution. Meanwhile, its ownership, either by Saudi Arabia or Abu Dhabi, and location remain a mystery. Asked how the show writers will verify the facts and explain the painting's complex narrative, the spokesman adds that the show is a theatrical production. The plot is based on the story, but, of course, strives to present a deeper and more metaphorical meaning. Like many theatrical presentations, artistic liberties will be freely taken to make an enlightening and entertaining experience. And that sounds like a bit of a must-experience event. But let's wait until it comes out, and perhaps we can read the reviews first, and if I'm lucky, I may be able to read them on this programme for you. And I think there's time for just one last curiosity, which comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 11th of July. Diorama is a big deal. The 252-lot natural history and taxidermy auction at Tennent's on June the 19th included this Victorian anthropomorphic diorama of card-playing, cigar-smoking red squirrels, circa 1870 to 1900. Very much in the manner of the great Walter Potter of Bramber, he of the Kitten's Wedding and Rabbit School, it features six rodents in a lavishly furnished interior. Four are playing cards around a pedestal table. Reputedly, the diorama came into the vendor's family in lieu of a debt owed to their grandfather in the early 20th century. It was offered with an estimate of £3,500 to £5,500, but sold for £11,000, nearly $25,000 all up. Will someone perhaps produce a taxidermy diorama of Australian animals playing an Australian game? Maybe four wombats playing two up, do you think? But not playing games, and on a more serious note, thank you for tuning into the Antiques Radio Show. 2RPH would like to invite you to spring into the future with us. Our donation campaign is underway. Please contribute by calling 02-9518-8811 during business hours or visit 2rph.org.au/donate. Thank you. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.